Tonight we are having a second talk by Dr. Alok Pandey on the subject of the integral yoga and other paths. Welcome. Namaskar.
So we see that, it's quite in continuation with whatever we have spoken about, the spiritual experiment. And now we can enlarge the scene that the earth itself has been a scene of a grand experiment, where the experiment of evolution has taken place. And this evolution, we find something very interesting, that at the human level, suddenly the evolution takes a very interesting course. And that course is that of all creatures upon earth, human beings just don't like to stay in limits. As somebody says, that make a rule and somebody will find a way to break it. Lawyers use it very well, incidentally. Any amount of rules and they find a loophole. There's something incorrigible in man.
Yeah.
And it's good that it is incorrigible. Something exists which wants to transcend boundaries and limits.
And that beautiful line in Savitri, no more in earthly limits pen thy force.
Exactly. Oh. So this process starts with human beings. We are programmed, hardwired for this. We cannot accept the fate and comply. We are talking about conquest. It's one of the signs of our manhood. You see, every time I pass this Ganesh temple, and I keep telling people about it, look at this little elephant the big elephant. This is a pity, She has no chains and poor lady is suffering, standing there doing all these gestures. Just amusing people, becoming nothing but a, mock show. If she one day realizes who she is, everybody will be helter-skelter. But she stays helplessly as if, without chains, she's tied to chains, she accepts. But with human beings, even if you put people in prison and chains, Shivinda wrote that wonderful thing about prison and freedom. Something in him will want to escape. And if he cannot escape outwardly, he will escape inwardly. And we have so many instances of people who within prison had such beautiful, revelation. And of all of them, we have the grandest example of Sri Aurobindo himself.
Yeah.
Who while in prison realizes some of the great truths of the yoga. In fact, the greatest truths of the yoga, not just some of the great truths. He had realized, the state of nirvana and silent consciousness. And he was already a Jivan Mukta. But there he realizes the great truths of the Upanishads. He often would, recite this mantra from the Ish Upanishad, where the mantra speaks about seeing the one self everywhere and in all beings. And he had realized the truth of the Gita, where he sees the Narayana everywhere. So at that stage, while in a prison, he realizes all these. All the past truths of the yoga had already come to him. And one wonders, after all this, what is it that inspired him to come to Pondicherry? He had experienced bhakti and the great truths of bhakti. In fact, his yoga had a great coloring of bhakti. He admitted that. Very often people think that Sri Aurobindo was more like a philosopher, and first of all, people think philosopher is equivalent to Gyan Yogi. Very far from
intellectual.
That. Intellectual. And when Sri Aurobindo was asked about his silent consciousness and Nirvana experience, what he says? It came to me suddenly, without much of an effort, by the grace of the Guru or the grace of Krishna and Kali, if you like. Who could see the world mother in an idol without having a heart which is given to, the creatrix? So Sri Aurobindo had these lines of experiences which were coming, crowding to him. Same thing we see in the mother, but for the moment we'll just see Sri Aurobindo, because their yoga has gone through very, very similar lines towards the same end. From the beginning, Sri Aurobindo said even from the beginning. So we see that all lines of spiritual efforts were crowding on to Sri Aurobindo, as if they were looking for their grand culmination. Now, with the advent of man, these efforts began, because man is not happy. He is always ill at ease. There is no one law of human being. That's why there are so many stratas of human beings. Almost like species within species within species within species. Unlike, you know, other creatures where there is a certain law. An animal, if it's a non-veg, will remain non-veg. How much ever you may put a tiger in a zoo, it will remain non-veg. And elephant with all his strength and the chimpanzee will always remain a vegetarian. Even though it can easily, you know, eat non-veg and kill. But with human beings, this tendency to change, to evolve, to grow, to exceed the limits. And the final result of this tendency was entry into the spiritual consciousness. A consciousness beyond mind, of which the past spiritual efforts have witnessed the glory and documented it so beautifully. But the problem of all these experiences were that if you really see that though they had actually found the same one reality, when they came to speak of that reality or communicate that reality, because speaking is impossible for what transcends the mind, we invariably find that there are several aspects as if each had glimpsed one side or one aspect of the reality.
Describing the elephant.
Describing the elephant. I was just talking about in the mother speaks of the story of the kinship tree, and which Ramakrishna, we'll just come to that, but we see that each of them is speaking of an aspect, and therefore it created many, many cult sects, approaches, and further down religions, philosophies, ways of looking at the creator and creation, etc., etc. Now, all these were interesting experiments, important experiments. Each became a tradition. When we talk about traditions, religions, sects, etc., each glimpse became a tradition in its own right. Where the tradition was sustained by a living lineage of gurus, it flourished and thrived. Like, you know, the Sikh gurus, there were 10 lineages. Similarly, there were mystics all over the world, Sufis and in India, where this tradition, even in Christianity, the Gnostics, it remained as a living truth. But the moment one of the last master was gone without leaving a higher apparent, this tradition had a tendency to degenerate into religion, because very naturally the master embodies the truth which far exceeds the word or the book or the scripture. Then men had a scripture in their hands which they didn't understand. How would a monkey understand the computer sciences and the poetry of, you know, Goethe and Valmiki? He's at loss. But the scripture was there, the word was there. And quite naturally, human beings kept on looking at the scripture and forgot the great vision behind it. Shobindu speaks of it that the scripture is a double-edged weapon. Wielded rightly, it can open a door. But used wrongly, it can, you know, destroy. You look what is happening, ISIS. They quote, Muhammad.
Quran, yes.
Jihad. Jihad is about inner fight and inner conquest. Do it by all means. But conquering those who are non-believers, apply it to those parts which are full of doubt, and it's wonderful. Apply it to the world at large, outer world, and you finish it. So this, and then the pandits came in for the vested interest. And so at one level, there was complete degeneration during the time of coming of Sri Aurobindo of the great spiritual truths, which had broken into many, many sects, subsects, so much so that sects began fighting with each other. We had the Vaishnavas and the Shaivites fighting with each other. We had, among Shaivites, two different types of Shaivites, and each said, my realization is greater. We had the Bhakta and the Gyan Yogi at loggerheads, whose is greater? Despite the great word of the Gita, when Arjuna asks him, who is greater, the Gyani or the Bhakta? And Sri Krishna says, you know what, Arjuna, I'll tell you a secret. Both come to me. Except that the Bhakta comes in a delightful way because I travel with him. Or at least he's aware that I travel with him. Whereas Jnani has to scale the peaks, holding the rugged slopes. And if he falls, you know, it's a terrible journey that he undertakes. Pantha Duratya. But he also comes to me. Gita was a synthesis. But as I said, when Sri Aurobindo came, all these once living traditions had turned into petty sects, subsects, an odd master here and there. But they too, each carrying his own set of disciples in some kind of an isolated forest or Himalayan peaks, and the world at large plunged into darkness. just before Sri Aurobindo, to clear the ground as it were, we see the mighty personality of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa, who comes and prepares the ground by showing in his own life and experience that, look, don't fight. Each religion and religious experience, if you go just one step further, you will enter into that state of unity where the differences will dissolve. And he had done it not only with Christianity and Islam, even with Hinduism. There was a point when he had to go beyond the image of Kali, and this was a very painful moment for him. And he did it, and he discovered the utter unity. And he spoke about it, he preached it, and he knew at some level that even the world and God have to be reconciled. That is why he asked Swami Vivekananda not to enter into Nirvana. That's the whole story. But he had prepared a ground. Of course, he was a child of the Divine Mother. And with that ground, that okay, unity of religion, not just tolerance, but a unity of religion, a unity of spiritual experience, fine. But for what purpose? If the end is merger into the absolute, then it all again makes no sense. And that's where we see Sri Aurobindo presaging, envisaging, as a precursor of the future, a question which today people, children, raise. And very often people come and tell me, you know, today's children, they just don't follow any religion. They have no belief in it. So they are very disturbed about it. And I have to tell them it's very good. It's very good. Their ground is getting ready for something much greater.
Yes.
Because what has it taught us at the end? We have forgotten the Vedas, the Upanishads and the Gita, their essence. We have forgotten that real ancient spiritual pursuit. Even Buddha, the mighty spirit of Buddha. And what we have today, religion as in, or spirituality as an escape. Religion as a means for just safeguarding your personal life. So and so God, so and so master, so and so deity will take care of my wealth, my job, my children. That's the end of the story.
Yeah.
And what are these spiritual paths? Escape for myself. What happens to world, earth, others? It doesn't matter.
It's the same in the West.
Everywhere. Because, you know, this is the great degeneration which took place. At least in the Vedic ages, we find an effort to reconcile, even if it didn't succeed. There was an effort, at least individually, to get illumination from that consciousness so that I can lead a better life. Look at the great Gayatri Mantra where the Rishi prays for illumination in the mind. And of course, Sri Aurobindo gave a new Gayatri where he talks about the whole being, not just the mind. Look at the, you know, word of the Upanishad we were speaking that day. Hiranmayena patrena satya sahipam mukham. Give me the law of truth so that I may lead a life in tune with truth, not as now attuned with falsehood. And you know this line incidentally from the Ish Upanishad, Yajnavalk, the great seer, who we see repeatedly reconciles world and the spirit. Ish Upanishad, Sri Aurobindo is spoken of as the foundation for divine life. And this famous line, Hiranmayena patrena satyasyap hitam mukham. The face of truth is covered by a golden lid.
Yes.
Reminds us of this line in Savitri, where Sri Aurobindo invokes the Divine Mother, says, oh, wisdom, splendor,
yes,
creatrix, the eternal's artist, bride. You are hidden there.
Yeah.
And come down upon earth.
He says, he writes to Champaklal on Champaklal's birthday, and he says, a veil behind the heart,
yes,
a lid over the mind.
Yes,
keep us from the divine.
Yes.
Love and devotion rend the veil, and in the silence of the mind, the lid thins and vanishes.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, this grand synthesis, Sri Ramakrishna showed the unity of religions and the spiritual experiences. But the next step was the unity of spiritual experiences and life upon world. Now, this was what was waiting for Sri Aurobindo's coming. And secondly, the unity of not just all mankind, but of all creation as a single unit, marching towards the divine, which is hinted in the Ish Upanishad, hinted in the Gita, where Sri Krishna speaks of Lok Sangrahartha. He says, Arjuna, why you should fight? He says, you are talking of spirituality, that you know you would be cleansed of all stains of sin and you will find a good, you know, booking a berth in heaven, fine. But have you thought about this earth and its march towards a luminous far, far off goal? And he says, fight for that. It's so amazing. Shivinda puts it so beautifully in Essays on the Gita, where he says, the answer of a hero to a hero. Realize this oneself. Look around you where light and darkness are locked in a conflict. And look above beyond the peaks towards which thou rises. Fight, if by fight the world must advance, either conquer grandly or perish nobly. This kind of a thing was forgotten. Now, this interweaving of the world and spirit together, not just for an individual, but for the whole creation. This idea that earth is doing the yoga, or rather divine is doing the yoga in the earth. Man or no man, the earth will realize its goal. This is another thing very often people, you know, miss out. And the mother spoke of that, you know, whether the earth will be saved, that is for sure. Whether the present civilization will be saved or not, the mother has left this question hanging. Yes. And I can say nothing more, nothing better.
Yes.
So, you see, we have a very anthropocentric view of life. Natural, I mean, like any other species, we are egoistically attached to our own kind, and we still talk only about being brothers and sisters to each other. Except in some quarters where people are thinking about this whole earth as one unit. Sometimes I view it as a great spaceship. The mother spoke about that great ship.
Yeah.
So I look at this earth as a great spaceship voyaging through eternity.
Buckminster Fuller called it Spaceship Earth.
Yeah. Ah, yes.
And that line in Savitri, Earth by this golden superfluity bore thinking man, and more than man shall bear.
So you see, the pilot of this spaceship is the divine, and we are interconnected whether we like it or not. There can be no isolated yoga which is cut off in cults and sects and limits. There can be nothing like an isolated escape. The day I understand that me and that and this and the bird, the beast, the stone, the stars, the drift of the galaxies and the dust which lies prostrate at our feet are manifold expressions of the one infinite, then where is the question of individual escape? Unless I regard myself as a separate individual entity, carrying my ego into the infinite, where of course it smashes and there is some kind of a dissolution or whatever. Now, this is something which Shobindu has brought out very powerfully and in the forefront of the quest. No more yoga for, you know, this kind of a my path, but a yoga for the earth. Everybody does yoga not for oneself. Superman, not so that I become a Superman, a great yogi. Everybody will respect me because I am Superman. Among the first lot. No. Superman is needed so that earth may become a better place. Whether I become or somebody else becomes, no problem at all. Mother herself spoke of that. First in her prayers, where she says, how does it matter what place one occupies? Whether at the center or at the periphery. She is willing to identify with the most ordinary consciousness. And she says that was a command given to her. Be like ordinary among ordinary men. And she became that. She came here and sat on the floor, taught people how to sit in front of Sri Aurobindo, would clean the floors herself, despite being Rajrajeshwari. Now this is, you know, this aspect where this sense of yoga itself becoming an elitist club, which degrades into religion, my religion. I am the faithful few, the chosen lot, have a seat booked in heaven by the very fact of being baptized.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, baptized or initiated, is the same thing. Others, they are poor mortals. Mind you, this exists everywhere. In one tendency or the other, I have seen it in spiritual movements in India, where people believe that if you have not come to my guru, you are lost. And people came and talked to me that, look, you know, Mother and Sri Aurobindo are not there, so you are not initiated technically by a living master. So do you know that, you know, unless you are initiated by a living master, you cannot find a place in the beyond.
So, unless you accept Jesus, you are doomed.
Exactly. The same tendency. So I had to tell them, look, I am not looking for a place in the beyond. Then they were quite confused. What are you looking for? And so much so that one, you know, as an aside, somebody even asked me, he said, okay, I'll tell you what is the difference between having a living master and not having a living master. I said, look, okay, what do you want to know? So he gave me, he asked me a cryptic phrase from one of the lines of one of the masters. He said, can you tell me its meaning? So just by mother's grace, I told him the inner meaning. Now, this was a meaning safeguarded within the four boundaries of the sect. Oh. So this man spent a sleepless night. How did he know it? So he came next day morning. No, I want to know how you know. Surely you have met somebody. I said, trust me, I have not met somebody. In fact, I started wondering what was so great about the meaning. To me, it was nothing so great, you know, to be so closely safeguarded. Now, this is what is Sri Aurobindo has broken or tried to break us free from this tendency. He has generalized the yoga to become a yoga of the earth. Look at Mother in the agenda saying even cats, dogs, trees are doing yoga.
Yes. And often ready to take birth in the
absolutely
human form.
Yes. Yoga is a concentrated evolution. So when we look at that and look at these hints are there in ancient Indian thought where, you know, Rama's yoga takes the form of carrying the earth together, you know, carrying the animal, the low, the monkey, everybody together, the Rakshasa, towards that culmination. So I keep telling people that, you know, there is a outer communism, which is a great distortion of a true socialism, which is from Vedanta, the divine socialism. Rama is a prototype of that. Now, Sri Aurobindo brings that so beautifully to the forefront. Look at the ashram. It is a commune. Commune where people are supposed to live without this sense of pride and I am someone special, I belong to an elite group, you know, all together. It was there even in some other traditions, like in Sikhism you have the langar, the guru's langar. Everybody sits together and eats without sense of pride. But over a period of time, there is a tendency to degenerate. And what Sri Aurobindo did, and I think what he is doing still, is breaking all forms of external kind which may once again create a tendency to make a kind of a limited religion. It obviously is a movement, a dangerous movement. It has its own plus, minus. It will go through its own. But in the long run, if I really look at it, it has its own place. He is not destroying the religious tendency, which is a different thing. This love for God, worship, devotion, faith, this is the most beautiful values or treasures of mankind. Without it, man would be no more man, but a violent asuric kind, without love in his heart, without faith, without worship. But at the same time, to limit this worship in some fixed forms, in some limited space, in some small group, in some set of rules, is a tendency which must go. To keep that essence, like the golden grain, and to remove the other things. And this is what we see in children. They are learning to connect in a way, in ways. I mean, after all, it's a spiritual evolution to start with. Let humanity as a bulk, as in large masses, enter into the realm of the spirit and learn to lead a life with a conscious awareness of the oneness which is behind creation, which is behind earth, with the spirit of Yajna, that there is an interdependence of everything and all is meant for all. This tendency is coming up, you know, speaking of the earth is flat. Mm. But who could do this, fulfill this tendency? It was that consciousness which has either stood behind or been just an executrix. And we spoke about that the other day, that whenever there is a time for such a transition from the old to the new, there is a need for the feminine, the dynamic side of the divine, step into the forefront.
Yes.
That is the mother, Aditi, the undivided consciousness. Even lower nature is she, but she in garb, she wearing tattered clothes, she wearing a dress which is not befitting to her glory, and yet she wears it. How the mother came and stayed in that, you know, hotel and in Karaikal, even in a place infested with white ants and rats. But that's not how the Divine Mother should be. So even lower nature is she, but she in garbs which are not worthy of the spirit. So very often when people say all is mother, so they say, well, I should live by the spontaneity of my nature. Well, that's again a misuse of an ancient truth. Because spontaneity of nature as of now is simply the vital, mental, physical nature, which is largely under the influence of the falsehood. So in ancient tradition we see freedom of the spirit, but nature continues to remain the same. At best, sattvic modification, even the eightfold path, or the Gita. Gita says that inwardly your soul will be free, but when you have to act under tamas, rajas and sattva. So it bids on to Arjuna to, you know, cultivate rajo-sattvic qualities, which are also the devic qualities, the godlike qualities. But inwardly, by constant remembrance, you will be free. But Shobindu goes one step further. He says, no, nature can be changed. Now, this is something which has never been heard of. Yeah. Our mind can be illumined with a plenary supramental light. Yes. It can be filled with a consciousness that is unwalled and unpartitioned. Our hearts will no more love simply this person or that person because my ego takes a preferential interest. Not even merely humanity, but extend to embrace whole earth, the titans and the gods and the stars and everything else.
Even the body shall remember God.
Remember God. This taste, the body, which has been totally discarded. So yes. This liberation, not just of the individual soul, which was a thing achieved by the great yogis past, but liberation of nature, not just a fulfillment of the soul. Vedanta, by the way, speaks about evolution. So, again, there is a common misconception that, you know, Shobindo picked up certain ideas from Darwin and spoke about evolution. This is total misunderstanding of the whole phenomena. It was good that Darwin came on the scene and introduced the idea of evolution. But in India, evolution already existed through forms. In Tantra, there is this, you know, they speak about 84 million species through which the soul migrates and transmigrates to arrive at its fullness. So it's an evolution through forms, but the emphasis is on the evolution of the little spark inside, not the evolution of nature, though it is taking place evidently, but it's not emphasized. Reach up to this point of man where eventually the soul has developed to a point where it can catapult into the infinite. But Shobindu says, no, why? If the inner soul can mate with the infinite, this finite mind, this finite life, this limited heart, these limited passions, this errant will, this very body, which is so fragile, can also mate with the strength, the light, the joy, the beatitude, the love, the freedom, the power of the infinite. So, wonderful. We'll stop this part today and take it up maybe next time.